The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Okay, here's one for you. Child star and Oscar-winning film director, Nine Letters. You need a minute? You got it? Ron Howard. I'm pretty sure he's the only person with that particular biography. In my childhood, he was already huge on The Andy Griffith Show, and then he came along and he was Richie on Happy Days. Off the screen, Howard made his name as a big-time Hollywood director and producer behind an amazing run of good films, sometimes even terrific films, romantic comedies like Splash, family flicks like Parenthood, and serious drama like Frost Nixon. The kind of wide-range career that you rarely see in filmmakers these days. In 2002, Howard returned to TV with a vengeance as the narrator of Arrested Development, a cult hit and a favorite of mine that had a short run, but a huge influence on modern comedy. The frequent rumors about a reboot of that show were on my mind when I had a chance to talk with Ron Howard at the American Magazine Media Conference.
When do you start shooting Arrested Development again? Make some news.
Okay, well, I'm not allowed to make any news. I have to kind of say what I've been saying, which is everybody has an appetite to do it. Mitch Hurwitz is dreaming up stories. He's the creator and the genius behind the whole thing. And really, the question is, the cast has become such a collection of superstars, is can you actually find the period of time when everybody can be there?
To schedule it. Did you have any sense that that show was going to turn into the cultural phenomenon that it did? Or did it seem like a kind of side project for you at the time?
I didn't know. It was very experimental. And in fact, it didn't work as a ratings getter on network, because it was pretty new territory stylistically and tonally. All I knew was that there was a new kind of TV grammar, mm-hmm, that I thought we could use for a family comedy.
How would you describe that? What does that mean?
It was a sort of reality TV based, a little bit what you were seeing on YouTube. And then I also felt like that if you could use a narrator and you could use flashbacks and all of these things, and actually I wanted to do interviews the way they do in The Office and Modern Family, and that didn't find its way into it. But I thought if you could do all that, you could get a kind of comedic density akin to what The Simpsons is able to generate, where it just kind of seems like chaos, but it all kind of comes together. On the one hand, it's about entirely self-serving, selfish people outside of the Jason Bateman character, maybe Michael Cera's character. But at the end of the day, it still sort of celebrates the possibility of love and connectivity. It's, can I find love? Am I worthy of love? If I'm not, is there a redemption story that would make me worthy of love?
Is that the story you're always trying to get at? In other words, you what's the thread for you that makes a Ron Howard film Ron Howard film?
I love all kinds of movies and television shows. And as an actor growing up on television, as I did, particularly in that era of the 60s and 70s, it was, TV was meant to sort of retell the same story in more or less the same way with little tweaks and new jokes and things like that. And so I knew when I began to you know, feel I'd have a career, and a lasting career as a director, that I could do the job of directing. And then the question was, what kinds of movies? The answer was, as many, all of them.
As some of the people here are old enough to remember, but probably very few, I remember it like it was yesterday, when you were 5, 6, and 7 years old.
Yeah.
You were a star of the Andy Griffith Show. Apparently Andy Griffith was on it as well, but you were the star as far as I'm concerned, and Aunt Bee was awesome. TV is a very collaborative form. Were you able as a 5, 6, 7 year old to participate, collaborate, or were you merely an instrument of everybody else's vision?
Well, I think in everybody's mind, I was an instrument. Right. In my mind, I was in there.
Yeah.
I was a part of it.
You were Marlon Brando.
I was very lucky. We would do these read-throughs on Thursdays, and the cast was allowed to stay around for a half an hour and just comment. So Don Knotts would talk about jokes, and everybody was allowed to. And I was allowed to stay and listen. And that first year, when I was 6 years old, once or twice, I actually raised a point. And there was, you know, just dead silence. No one cared about my ideas at all. And it annoyed me that they weren't really listening. And I remember very vividly the second episode of the second season, and I had just turned 7. I had done Music Man in the off season, was feeling pretty good about myself, obviously. it was a rehearsal. No wardrobe or anything yet. And I opened the door at the sheriff's office, and you know, Andy was over on the other side, and Otis the drunk was in the jail cell, and Barney was over here looking for his bullet or something. And I did what I always did, was say, hey, Paul, and then go into whatever my line was supposed to be. But I remember stopping and saying to the director, I don't think a kid would say it that way. And they said, well, how do you think a kid would say it? And I sort of pitched my little rewrite. And he said, okay, good, say it that way. And I remember being so gratified by that, feeling that I was a part of something, a part of a process. I mean, it was so rewarding. And I had to have been smiling because Andy said from across the set, what are you grinning at, youngin'? He actually would talk that way.
Really? Just like my household.
And I said, well, that's the first idea of mine that you've said yes to. And there was a little pause, and he said, well, it was the first one that was any damn good. Now let's rehearse the scene. So I was blessed.
Andy Griffith was kind of abusive, wasn't he?
He was great. And I was blessed to be around this problem solving. So, you know, the themes weren't changing. The big ideas were in place. The tone was there. But there was this endless tweaking, refining, understanding, and trying to find this spot where things felt natural and yet, you know, they were funny. And I also taught about, you know, all about comedy timing and things like that that wound up being very useful. But mostly what I learned about is that you can have a lot of fun on a set, there can be a lot of laughs, but you need to know the story you're telling. In fact, as a director and a producer, what I try to do more than anything is just create an environment where I am sort of the keeper of the story. I have the final word, but I love the spirit of collaboration. I love creating an environment where I feel like talented people in front of and behind the camera can really excel. And it is about an ongoing conversation as to what else? What else we can do to give this dimension and to give it depth and also give it currency. What makes popular entertainment really work is that it does have to have some relevancy.
Well, I think we've been very disciplined in not discussing politics for a full 15 or so minutes, but I would like to run a clip of a political movie that you made some time ago. This is from Frost Nixon.
Mr. President, now you've always maintained that you knew nothing about any of this until March 21st. Oh. But in February, your personal lawyer came to Washington to start the raising of $219,000 of hush money to be paid to the burglars. Now, do you seriously expect us to believe that you had no knowledge of that?
None. I believe the money was for humanitarian purposes, to help disadvantaged people with their defenses.
Well, it was being delivered on the tops of phone booths with aliases and at airports by people with gloves on. That's not normally the way lawyers' fees are delivered.
Look, I have made statements to this effect before. All that was Haldeman and Ehrlichman's business. I knew nothing. Okay, fine. You made a conclusion there. I stated my view. Now let's move on. Let's get on with the rest of it.
No, hold on.
No, I don't want to talk to you.
Haldeman and Ehrlichman were the ones really responsible. When you subsequently found out about it, why didn't you call the police and have them arrested? Isn't that just a cover-up of another kind?
Well, maybe I should have done that. Maybe I should have just called the feds into my office and said, hey, there's the two men. Haul them down to the dock, fingerprint them, and then throw them in the can. I'm not made that way. These men, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, I knew their families. I knew them since they were just kids. Oh, yeah, but you know, politically, the pressure on me to let them go, that became overwhelming. So I did it. I cut off one arm, then I cut off the other, and I'm not a good butcher. And I have always maintained what they were doing, what we were all doing, was not criminal. Look, when you're in office, you gotta do a lot of things sometimes that are not always, in the strictest sense of the law, legal. But you do them because they're in the greater interests of the nation.
Right, wait, just so I understand correctly. Are you really saying that in certain situations, the president can decide whether it's in the best interests of the nation and then do something illegal?
I'm saying that when the president does it, that means it's not illegal.
I'm sorry?
That's what I believe.
Now,
what's old gets new again?
Yeah. The Trump presidency is already in the courts. The Trump presidency is also challenging the status of the news media, of the arts, of truth itself. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine making a Donald Trump movie? I didn't mean to ruin your day.
I hope it turns out to be a Broadway musical comedy and not an American tragedy. As a storyteller, it's a very interesting time. You know, I mean, it gets back to that idea of popular entertainment needing to speak to audiences today and also often addressing fears, mm-hmm. even if it's lighthearted, even if it's comedic. You know, you need to be sort of hitting those buttons and those places where anxiety, you know, exists. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see, because in this period where niche programming works in a lot of ways, you can speak to a direct audience, whether it's movies or
TV. But that's not your thing. Your thing is to reach not a red audience or a hard red audience or a hard blue audience. Your thing, as I interpret it, forgive me if I'm stretching the point, is to reach a purple audience, to reach in an emotional, visceral, but also mindful way,
yeah.
a very, very broad, maximal audience, which is an old-fashioned idea in a certain way. Can it be done when the subject is political?
Well, the subject doesn't have to be overtly political to be political. I mean, there are storytellers that feel like everything you ever say is in some way political. But it is a very interesting time in that way, and I do think there's going to be a kind of a pressure or a yearning from audiences to sort of look at the polar opposites, portray that in some way that's relatable, but also talk about the possibility of this sort of coming together. And what does purple art look like? What does a purple existence look like? Is there something in there? So I don't know I don't have the answers of the show or the movie, but I can just sense that there's a question looming. And I also think there's going to be a kind of magnetic pull from a lot of people to sort of say, acknowledge the reality of the differences that people feel, mm-hmm. and then suggest the possibility of common ground and how can we either have fun with that, you know, or explore it. I think there's going to be a real urgency to try to be in the moment in some compelling, interesting, provocative way.
I know you have a long conference, so I want to end on time. I want to thank Ron Howard for your work and for your presence here today. Thanks so much.
Pleasure. Thanks very much.
Producer, director, and child star, Ron Howard.